I think a lot of things are at stake now, and we're at the point where cybercrime is borderless. And we have to think about how do we protect all the data that we are putting out there. Everything is digital these days, and we are dependent on these systems.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Hey everyone, it's KB. Thank you for being an active listener on the show. And thanks to you, we've been downloaded in 63 countries. If you haven't already, please ensure that you follow and subscribe to the show for the latest updates. Now, time to get to the interview. Joining me today is Sean Duca, Regional Chief Security Officer, APJ, from Palo Alto Networks. And today we're discussing Palo's 2023 Unit 42 Ransomware and Extortion Report. So Sean, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with some of the insights from the report. Now, Australia is the number one targeted country in the APJ region. So talk to me about this.
So the big thing from the actual report itself is obviously many organizations are being targeted across the globe and even in different sectors. But in light of the fact that we've had a lot of different, I guess, attacks that have actually taken place, it happened to land right at the point where we're actually generating the report. So this is where Australia did come up, I guess, come up on the top of the list, but obviously for all the wrong reasons, which was the fact that we are seeing many organizations being compromised. And a lot of that just comes down to ensuring that they are doing the right cyber hygiene in their own organization and not falling victim to ransomware attacks.
So do you think it's also heightened? I know we're sort of talking more about ransomware, but do you think it's also heightened because of all those big public breaches as well? Do you think that it's we're just hearing more of it? And I know that the other big profiles breaches were more related to data breaches, but do you think it's all sort of coupled up into the same sort of issue?
I think it's a bit of both, if I'm really honest. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that we've always probably, I'll say that we've probably been a little bit immune or desensitized to a lot of the attacks that have been taking place across the globe, because we always thought, who would target us? What are we doing that's so different or special? But the reality is everyone's a victim. Everyone could be a victim and everyone is actually a target. When you think about it, cyber criminals will cast their net as far and wide as they possibly can to get, you know, some sort of financial motivation or some sort of financial reward or a bit of data that they could then on-sell to someone else to get some money out of it.
So you make a great point saying, you know, because we live in Australia, it's like, oh, no one really cares about what we have to, you know, do. We're not going to be targeted. But you're saying we are. So why are we being targeted? Is it just, like you said, casting the net wide, easy hit, or is it more intentional than that?
This is something that's always been happening. And I think there's an element where we're probably – the media is reporting it a lot more, and every single time there is some form of data breach, ransomware attack, whatever you want to sort of call the actual theme of it, we're seeing this being reported every single time. Whereas previous times, I think a lot of these things went unreported. Some people didn't even know that they were actually targeted and they were compromised. So I think we're just seeing the true reporting coming out, or at least as close to the true reporting as possible. But then the other part is, you know, many organizations don't apply the right rigor around, you know, the right level of hygiene. And that means, you know, patching your systems, ensuring that, you know, you have actually locked down multiple ways that an attacker could come inside the organization.
So I'm curious to know, and I had this conversation with someone this week, I forget who it was, but they were saying, do you think that there are more attacks or the media is reporting it more? So are you saying that, I don't know, 7 years ago we've had the same level of attacks? Is it the same? Has it increased? Or is it just feels like there's more because people like me and friends are talking about it more?
We're definitely seeing a lot more reported, number one, in the media. And I think the other part is we're also seeing a lot more attacks taking place. You know, it is financially lucrative and the rewards are actually quite high for cyber attackers. So why would they not? And we've seen a number of different rants where gangs actually pop up. We've seen different types of organizations being compromised by other types of cyber criminals. And the reality is, this is going to continue to happen. I think it's a case of it's status quo. So what can people do? Start to actually batten down the hatches and protect your own organization.
So I just want to, in the report, one of the insights that I observed was manufacturing, professional and legal services, and wholesale and retail were the most targeted industries. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a couple of different elements. If you think about a manufacturing, you know, organization, I think about it more as around, more around the fact that it's a plant or a factory. You know, they are beholden to, you know, they have to ensure that they are constantly available and always running. So if you target an organization like that, it's probably a highly likely chance that someone would want to pay because one, they probably haven't protected themselves enough. The other part is they have got upstream and downstream suppliers. That's kind of critical for them to continue their business and operations as much as they possibly can. That would make, you know, in my eyes, that would make logical sense why manufacturing organizations would be targeted. There's a number of different types of devices that are out there. Some of those devices probably don't even have any security. You know, a lot of them could also be, you know, similar to in healthcare where you've got a number of black boxes that are managed remotely by different vendors that are sitting on the network. And it's the same network as a whole bunch of other systems.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there. Devices, what type of a devices? Can you give an example?
So if you think about just something as simple as a robotic arm, and if you think about the world that we are moving more and more into, you've got a lot of industrial IoT devices that would be sitting inside manufacturing plants. You know, there could be everything from, you know, measuring or like it could be a number of different types of sensors that are measuring, you know, the water flow, the temperature, you name it. That's effectively what a lot of those use cases are around industrial IoT devices. So they are potentially, and if you think about, you know, all the reports that have come out around IoT devices for the same, for the last few years, and I'd say probably the last 4 or 5 years, the OWASP vulnerability list has not changed for IoT devices. And that is the top five vulnerabilities typically are, there is no secure way to actually update the operating system or the application. They typically have just simply a username and password to get into that system. You know, there's a number of different things that devices are actually being made with no security in mind. And we really have to shift that paradigm where it's security by design. Because if they are being connected to the network, I would say that it's akin to this century's, you know, minefield. If you think about it, times of war, landmines were actually placed all around different parts of the world during conflicts. And after that, no one really remembered where the mines were actually left. So you all end up seeing in the news multiple times where something will just go off in 5 years from now, 10 years. You know, that's the same thing that we'll potentially see with IoT devices that are being connected to provide some sort of service or some sort of capability. And in the end, you know, if no one updates it, guess what? You know, you've got libraries that are constantly being, or vulnerabilities are being found in different libraries that are being used on some of these systems. So it's inevitable that we're going to see challenges popping up today and even in the future.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in the network that you said which was quite interesting. Now, going back to manufacturing, for example, so the two reasons, yep. You know, your hypothesis were that they're running upstream and downstream in terms of suppliers, which makes sense, and they're constantly running, which makes them a more sort of highly targeted industry. What about legal services, though? Because they're not like always running. Why would you think that they would be targeted as like a manufacturing? Because what you're saying absolutely makes sense. It's logical. But I'm just then curious to sort of see what the crossover would be with legal services. I mean, I don't know. I don't think they run 24/7, like legal practices close down at 5 p.m.
Yeah, I would say from a legal standpoint, it's the data, it's the information. You know, I think that's one industry that it's interesting that it's actually appeared, number one. It's also an industry that if you talk to barristers at the best of times, they seldom want to use technology. They are all about sort of handwriting and writing information. But think about the types of things that a legal service firm could actually have. Mergers, acquisitions, you know, information that could be market sensitive. You know, things like that are also a very good way that people could steal information and release it. It actually impacts organizations through that process. Because the part around what we found in the report is it's not just simply ransomware is installed and, you know, here's the ransom note, please pay X amount of dollars. It's all around multiple levels of extortion now. So we're seeing extortion get to the place where, or the point where we're seeing the encryption actually being installed. And then at that point, we're seeing harassment. We're seeing levels of, you know, distributed denial of service attacks that are taking place against organizations, data theft, you know, doxing, you know, organizations where they're just simply leaking it out. And that's where it starts to become that pressure cooker situation for an organization who has been impacted. And all of a sudden, they're now actually making it very public. They're harassing the organization. You know, we've seen instances where an organization will turn and go, this hasn't really impacted us. And the cyber attackers will actually come out of the woodwork and say, are you sure about that? Because we can release the data right now.
My gosh. Yes, totally hear what you're saying. Just going back to the IoT, you sort of mentioned before, you gave the analogy, which I liked, around the landmines that could just go off in 5-10 years. Do you think that that's, we're going to see that? So it's like, I don't know, 5 years from this interview, something's going to happen from an IoT device perspective, or?
Absolutely. Think about it right now. If you've got a Windows XP device and you want to connect it to a, you know, a raw internet connection, in less than 12 minutes, it's going to be compromised. So when you think about IoT devices, you know, depending on whose report you read, it's going to be somewhere between 40 million and 120 million devices are going to be connected in literally the next 5 to 10 years. So when you start to think about the complete, you know, this massive influx of devices are going to be out there, these devices don't have a secure way to get updated. That means they're going to be running old software. If you and I created a little organization that created industrial IoT devices, today's the day that we're going to use whatever is current from software that's available right now. Open source, a range of different things like that. But if we can't update it, guess what? There's going to be problems. Think of something like Log4j. You know, if that's actually out there, who's to stop someone from actually doing that? And if you think about devices that have been compromised, you know, there's a range of IPTV cameras that many years ago were compromised, about 190,000, and were part of a Mirai botnet that took down half the internet.
So from my understanding, and maybe you know more about this, I believe they are trying to bring in regulation for IoT devices. I think it's called like MUD, M-U-D, or something like that. And maybe I'm wrong, but they are trying to do that because you are right. Like, who's to stop anyone from making these low-level devices that are not secure? So prime example would be our trusty telcos and our Wi-Fi's. Like, in terms of, you know, hackers on the, you know, the SSID, hackers know that syntax is very easy to hack, right? So that actually then makes it not as secure. But then I've had this conversation on this show before, and they're like, I'm like, so why don't people change it? Well, it costs more money to do that. So do you think that maybe people can be bothered, like, trying to make something more secure, like from a device perspective, because it is cheaper to manufacture things? That's like, oh, okay, well, even if we make it more secure, that's going to cost us an extra 30% to manufacture, and we don't really want to do that.
Absolutely. I think there's a range of different factors in the example that you used there. So if you think about a router that is connected to the internet, a lot of routers always have the firmware that needs to be updated. People turn around and believe that it's the ISP's responsibility, and the ISP will do that. I don't really know of many ISPs that are actually updating routers that are actually out there, remotely at least. So then it's up to the individual. And if you think it's them and they think it's them, you know, they believe that you should be doing that, all of a sudden we're in this place where no one's actually doing it. And think about a router. You know, how often are you changing your router? Hardly ever. You know, you connect to the internet and it's on. And a lot of those devices have got old firmware, they've got things that are out of date. And if you've turned on some of these settings that weren't really probably the best, take the example of remotely accessing the web user interface on these devices. Half the time, that's where it's actually getting exploited. You know, a vulnerability will be found and then someone will start to exploit that particular piece.
Yeah, I know. And I do hear what you're saying. And I guess it's, you know, that's why we have this show, it's up for discussion, it's up for debate, it's up to having an opinion on like what is actually happening out there. You mentioned before about IoT. So I think that that is a real issue. I mean, it's something that I wanted to just quickly ask you about because it's something that does worry me. And I haven't actually spoken about IoT from a security perspective for a while. So maybe I need to bring that topic back. But I want to sort of switch gears now. Let's talk about data theft. Now, you mentioned it before in terms of the legal industry. But data theft, which is often associated with dark web leak sites, was the most common of the extortion tactics. Now, you mentioned it before, Sean. Now, in the report, it says 70% of groups using it by late 2022, a 30% increase from the year prior, according to Palo Alto Networks report. So we're seeing data breaches left and right. You mentioned it before with the high-profile ones, but then also companies saying, oh, we'll just, you know, leak more of your data out there on the dark web. So I'm curious to really get into this now, because this is where it gets really interesting.
Yeah. So look, in the end, it's all about applying pressure and, you know, coercing someone, harassing someone to really pay. And in the end, everything was always up for negotiation from what we've seen. You know, some people believe, don't talk to the cyber attackers, let's completely just walk away. That's good if you've got a plan and you know how to actually get around it. But if you are compromised, and think about even maybe critical infrastructure, a hospital, you know, what happens then? What do we do? If all the systems are locked out and data has actually leaked out, you know, all of a sudden it's sensitive information. You know, we saw that with some of the recent with one of the recent breaches that actually took place. You know, it was very opportunistic. They basically went down the path and say, oh, let's have a look at a certain type of, you know, medical claim that may have been there. And lo and behold, data got released. It was all about trying to apply pressure to an organization to pay.
And you mentioned there are multiple levels to it, and you said that harassment. So when you say harassment, like what are we dealing with here? Like,
it could be harassment from leaking it onto a leak site, distributed denial of service to actually shut down an organization's web presence. You know, going down the path of even just simply starting to put things out in the news. You know, telling an organization that they haven't, or stating the fact online that an organization has been compromised puts an organization in a precarious situation. You know, maybe that organization wanted to actually keep it quiet and didn't want to report it to a regulator, the news, shareholders, whatever it may be.
So would you say it's, in terms of the harassment and the levels to it, that's definitely increased in like historically of just like, oh, you know, we want a fee now. Like now you're saying there's multiple angles to it, which is getting their outcome of getting the money.
Absolutely. You know, we saw that the initial attack vector was just encrypt the data that was there. Then we started to see multiple levels of extortion take place. You know, it then started to snowball. And now we're at the point where we're also putting extortion and harassment together. You know, let's completely shut down. Let's launch a extremely large amount of, you know, data to be sent, all, you know, benign data, if anything. But it was all requests, you know, to someone's website to say, hey, I want to request, I want to check to your website. You know, if you start sending 300 gigabytes worth of requests to an organization's web presence, there's not many people that can actually sort of block something like that.
So in the report, it says 30% increase from the previous year. Like that 30% is still a fair bit in 1 year. Why do you think that would be that, like, that's quite a massive jump? Is there any sort of key indicators to why you think that would be so high?
I just think that it goes back to the point that I made earlier, which is we are seeing an opportunity present itself to cyber attackers. They know that people probably haven't done the right thing around applying, you know, cyber hygiene in their own organization. They've seen that organizations will pay. And even if you look at, you know, the stats that come out from FBI's Incident Center, you know, a lot of that actually comes down to how much people are actually paying. And that's based on reported information. And the report information, they believe, is probably only about 5% of the true scale of what's actually out there. And we're talking billions of dollars. So the key part, I think, for, you know, everyone, maybe even governments, to start to think about is, let's start to mandate the reporting of, you know, ransomware attacks. Because the more that we can start to see this, the more that we get visibility, the more that we can actually start to apply policy. You know, I think that's a key part.
So do you have any sort of numbers? I mean, look, I'm just genuinely curious of what people are paying. And like you said, they're not maybe accurate. And are people shying away from how much they paid? Because I guess there's that opens up the next door of the people judging from the sideline conversation, as you and I have spoken about before. Do you pay? Do you not pay? And then there's always going to be someone that's saying, oh, why did you pay? You shouldn't have not paid. But it's not so clear cut as that.
So I think when you look at how, don't get me wrong, there's a very big case to say don't pay, because that basically fuels further attacks. It can also fuel, you know, a terrorist organization and, you know, and something to that effect. So I get that part. But when you are looking at something like a critical infrastructure provider that has had ransomware attacks targeted to that, what do you do? You know, how do you actually get your systems back up and running? Let's just say it's a power plant. How do we do that? How do we clean it up? How do we actually get the data that we need off those systems? Sure, those particular systems are not really data-driven per se in a power plant. A lot of it's based on integrity and availability of the information. You know, think of what we saw many years ago with, you know, a Centris news that was actually saying all things are good on the main screen, but that behind the scenes, it was spinning around and was actually ready to catch fire and basically destroy part of a centrifuge in a uranium enrichment plant. So there's things like that we have to factor in. You know, to cause other issues. And if it's critical infrastructure, a severity one issue in an IT world is servers down. Severity one issue in critical infrastructure is life-threatening.
Yes, you're absolutely right. In terms of, I don't know, Sydney water gets contaminated, that's life-threatening.
Yeah.
So what do you think, so now that, you know, there's obviously SOCI and there's other things that are coming in terms of like regulation and stuff like that, but things that I'm hearing in the market is about, you know, we should be more focused on critical infrastructure. Do you think people are focused on critical infrastructure, or do you think that they, you know, they're thinking about it, but it's maybe not as top of mind as, you know, some of the things that we're discussing here today?
I think when you look at SOCI, where we've now got 11 sectors that are now deemed as critical infrastructure, we're at a point where some organizations haven't really thought about security the way that others have. You know, take the example of financial services. You know, they set the bar quite high around this is what, you know, good looks like. But then you've got other organizations like transport. They've never really thought about it. And when I say they've never really thought about it, they've never thought about it to the extent that a bank would. And maybe they've done some rigor around protecting their systems. But if a transport and logistics organization was to go offline, we can't get things around the country. In fact, the example of during the, you know, rolling out the COVID vaccine, you know, we had challenges doing that because a large transport company was actually targeted and hit at that point. You know, if you were to start to see, let's just say, you know, we end up having a drought, which is something that is quite common to actually happen in our country, or has been at least years ago. You know, all of a sudden, how do we get water out to cattle that are actually out in the middle of a field? You know, a cow drinks 90 liters of water a day. How do we do that if we've got no trucks? What happens if we've got no diesel?
So would you say, because FinServices, now I've got a FinServices background, is because it's regulated? APRA, like, is coming in there and saying, you know, we're going to audit you guys versus unregulated industries. Do you think that's why they pay more attention to having better security, because it is regulated?
I think that there's definitely an element of, you know, regulation. There is also an element of they have been targeted for many, many years. And it really comes down to, you know, think about the old, you know, there was a famous bank robber, and, you know, he was interviewed at one point in time in the US. And they asked him, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. So when you think about it from that context, you know, banks have had to do things for many, many years. And they did that to protect their customers. They did that to protect themselves. So it wasn't just regulation or a regulator that was actually dictating things. But over the years, we've seen more and more challenges be presented, and the regulators are actually standing up and saying, let's be very prescriptive. In some parts of the world, others are actually saying, let's put it around principles, where it's more around how do you actually manage risk? Prove to me how you manage risk. And I think this is something that we could all learn from other sectors to see how it actually works in financial services. I don't think that regulation is just the answer every single time, but I think if you were to apply logic around, you know, good ethics, how would you actually, you know, maintain some level of hygiene in an organization? You know, we can come up with the ideas and also start to implement, this is what good looks like. How about we aim for that?
It's a great point in terms of the aiming. But would you say people who are not in FinServices are looking at banks and saying this is what good looks like and mirroring what they're doing? And the reason why I ask that, or ask maybe that 30% wouldn't be 30%, it may be 10. So maybe that's not really happening in reality.
I wouldn't necessarily say that they're looking at other sectors to say that's what good is, let's mimic that. I think a lot of people are just simply looking at SOCI as it is and trying to work out what are my obligations and how do I meet that.
So in recent months, the Australian corporate regulator ASIC has warned that it will be seeking record penalties for breaches of market disclosure, as you know, and in particular those related to cyber attacks. Now, yeah, you've made a public comment, Sean, which I'll read out because I wrote the story on it. But would you say ASIC is cracking down? I mean, look, we've had these very public breaches. We've had a recent, again, public breach in a FinServices industry. So what's the verdict on that one?
We're at a point in time where regulators are really going to be coming down hard on board of directors, organizations in general. You know, we've seen the Privacy Act change and be modernized to today's world. And things like that will continue to take place. You know, sitting there and saying, we didn't know, and, you know, we never thought that this would be a problem, or why would someone actually attack us? I don't think that's an excuse you're going to be able to use anymore. And whether it was actually used beforehand, you know, it could be debated. But the key thing is it's everyone's responsibility. And from a board of directors standpoint, their approach is obviously they focus on governance, which is all about, you know, noses in, fingers out. And that's really around making sure that the people that are actually running the business, you know, are actually applying the right controls, the right people, processes that are in place. And from a board of directors standpoint, they should be inquiring and be very inquisitive around how are you managing the risk. You know, this big thing that you're talking about, you know, that's a new strategic imperative that we've got for an organization. That may be the thing that's going to propel us forward to generate revenue, products, or more, you know, new route to market. How are you managing the risk on that? Because if we're putting all of our eggs into this new thing that they are creating, you know, how are we managing the risk? And they are valid questions that a board of directors should be asking of an organization. And in turn, the organization should be able to respond and say, this is how we're managing the risk. And it should be with no techno babble. It should be more around the fact that this is categorically how we're doing it. Because a lot of people need to get their, let's call it their cyber knowledge up. But I think that common lexicon that we need to have between technical and business to technical has to be applied every single time. So board of directors, I think I'm really starting to think about what they should be asking and and expecting good answers from those organizations that they are sitting on the board of.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in here that I'm curious about. So company A gets breached. What does then ASIC do about it? So they give you a penalty or whatever the fine is, and then what happens? Is there more to it? Like, what can people sort of, you know, expect that these are the ramifications of a breach, for example?
I don't necessarily think it's going to be a case of someone's been breached, ASIC turns around and says, here's the fine and you're done. There's going to be a lot of questions that will be asked around, how did you actually try and manage the risk before this happened? And if you can't prove that you took reasonable steps, you can't prove that in all the meeting minutes from the board meetings that cyber was spoken about, that's going to be a challenge. And I think there's probably going to be some sort of legal liability that may be applied to a board of director. Fines can be applied to an organization or given to an organization. And we may start to see that, you know, some people probably could also be unfit to actually be sitting on a board or even running an organization, because I think a lot of things are at stake now. And we're at the point where, you know, cybercrime is borderless. And we have to think about how do we protect all the data that we are putting out there. Everything is digital these days, and we are dependent on these systems. You know, from a consumer standpoint, we're also beholden to these people that have our information, our data. So we also have to start ensuring that, you know, what are people doing about that? And, you know, I think we should all be inquisitive and ask questions. How do you protect my data? You know, I've seen many times where you could even go to a cafe and they're saying, hey, can I get your date of birth? And maybe they're actually trying to track some information so they can, you know, market to you. And when it's your birthday, maybe they'll send you a birthday card or give you a free coffee. But you just sit there and ask yourself, why does a cafe need my date of birth? You know, we all collectively as organizations need to start sitting down and thinking about what is the data that we hold? You know, I think the laws will be updated and changed to say you don't need to keep data for as long as, you know, we've previously seen. But some organizations have just simply been keeping it for forever and a day. You know, big data was the promise of collect as much information as you can, and one day we'll be able to work out how to extract value out of it. Some organizations have managed to do that. Others have done nothing. If you think about how we protect ourselves during summertime when there are bushfires, you know, we do backburning. Why don't we start thinking about doing data backburning in our organizations?
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there which I'm interested to find out more. Okay, so company X gets breached, ASIC or whoever come in and say, hey, we're going to do a bit of investigation, ask you a lot of questions. So you're saying that a company needs to show reasonable endeavors that they try to protect their organization. Is it going to be hard to prove though? And can you give an example of what types of things that people need to show? Hey, like actually we tried to do the right thing and we failed. Is it going to come down to security strategy? Is it going to come down to tooling? Is it going to come down to the team? Because is that going to be hard to prove that a company had the right intention?
When you think about what's discussed in a board meeting, there's meeting minutes that are actually taken. If you were to take a glance at any annual report for an organization, have a look and just do a quick search on the word cyber. And you'll be surprised that sometimes you don't see anything. Other times, you know, someone will actually say, our cyber risk is X. So that gives you a pretty good perspective on how often people are talking about it. And if it's not in the annual report, probably a good sign to say that maybe they're not talking about it or they're not even talking about it enough.
Right. Yes, that makes total sense now. And that would then lead to, no, you're not doing reasonable endeavors to protect this organization. On another random side to that, now with the personal liability, as we know, that's a thing in the US. I was talking to someone, 2 weeks ago, they're from the US and they were here just on work on a work trip, and I was like, do you think that this will start to come in Australia? And like his hypothesis was yes. What do you sort of think of that? Like leading into before when you mentioned around like board of directors may be unfit for the position, and it, you know, that's going to pose a little bit more risk to them as individuals because of a, I don't know, data breach that happened. They didn't do reasonable endeavors to protect the organization. Are you really in a position to be on the board? Do you think we're going to see more of that come into Australia?
Absolutely. I definitely said it's going to happen because if you look at the where the winds are blowing in other parts of the world, it's already there or it's even coming. If you think about it, in an organization, there is what's called D&O policies. And a D&O policy is a director and officer liability insurance. Those policies need to be really carefully looked at by anyone who is a board of director or an officer of a company because sometimes it may not cover you. It may not cover you to the full extent because if there is, you know, a D&O policy, it's all about in providing insurance to protect the personal assets of a corporate director and the officers, their spouses, in the event that something was to go wrong and someone was sued in that organization. I recently did my AICD corporate directors course and, you know, people were sharing some anecdotal stories where they looked at the D&O policy, it basically covered nothing. So you're walking into a world where you've got no legal liability or protection in the event that someone decides to sue. Yeah, look at what we're seeing right now, you know, class action lawsuits against organizations because they didn't do the right thing.
So hypothetically, personal liability comes in, it's a thing. Do you think we'll see an increase if you were to do a search on the board minutes / annual reports for cyber? You'll see that popping up a little bit more, perhaps, if people are personally on the hook for these types of things?
Absolutely. It's a great motivator.
And so I now want to talk a little bit more broadly about maybe, you know, we've spoken about many public breaches. So would you say that companies are sort of handling their duty of care to their customers to the best of their ability? Now, I ask this because, you know, last few months haven't really supported that theory as much. And I guess it's hard, and I understand that. But obviously we could do better and there's more things that we can be doing. But would you say that this will start to change now? Because there's, you know, there's three very large public breaches in the last like 6 or so months.
Look, I think there will be change. I think a lot of it's also going to come down to the fact that people have probably done what they thought was right. And I think sometimes people also didn't really know what was the right thing overall. And, you know, I've sat down with many board of directors where they're not, you know, technically, you know, they're technical illiterates when it comes down to like technology or even cyber for that matter. So if they're not aware of what the questions are that they should be asking, they definitely aren't going to be able to understand the answers that are actually presented to them. And I think that's a key part. So are people doing the right thing? I would say that it's hard to you know, tar everyone with the same brush and say, absolutely. Because I think you've got levels of maturity in every single organization and every single sector as well. Some are doing amazing things, but think about the world that we live in. Small to medium enterprises make up 99% of the businesses in Australia. They're typically around 20 people. So when you think about who runs security there, and that could be, you know, Jan in accounts payable, because someone actually once asked her a security question, she knew the answer, so all of a sudden she's now responsible for security. You know, that does happen. And, you know, is it the right thing? Well, this is where people have made decisions to say, oh, let's just use some antivirus software. Or we bought 5 laptops from Harvey Norman and they had pre-installed some anti-malware solution. Is that enough? No. What happens if that business gets targeted? You know, their server is effectively the heartbeat of their entire organization. So they need to think about how do they protect it? Because, you know, the last couple of years, what we've seen, things change pretty quickly. And when you start to struggle with, you know, selling your products and services out of the market, $100,000 ransom could actually shut someone's business down.
Yes, that is very true. What about board representation from a cyber perspective? Now, I ask this because around all those large profile cases last year, I interviewed partner at DLA Piper and he was saying he was getting lots of calls from, you know, very large organizations and boards. And I was just curious to say, like, any of them from like a tech or cyber background? And the answer is no. So that would probably indicate we don't really have enough representation from a cyber or tech perspective. So do you think we'll start to see that change over time?
Potentially, yes. If I think about, again, sort of in my class, I was one of 25 people and I was the only one that had a tech background and knew cyber. You know, the majority of people are either lawyers or accountants by trade. So when you look at it from that side of it, you know, does it make up the entire thing? Absolutely. You know, cyber impacts the entire organization. You know, some people are concerned and scared about, they're going to be on the hook because of the financial statements. Well, guess what? You know, an email could actually be sent to an organization. Someone could open up the attachment or click on the URL there, and that could also take down the organization. So I think we need to ensure that there is a balance and people see that cyber is a vector for good and bad things. But cyber attacks happen. And we need to work out ways to manage the risk. You know, do we either accept it? Do we mitigate it? Do we transfer if you can transfer? Or do we actually avoid it somehow? And I think that's a decision that an organization has to make. They are the four choices that typically you have when it comes to risk management.
So you mentioned something before. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about data backburning, which I like. Do you think that people are going to start to employ data backburning? Yes, I'm familiar with, big data. Let's get as much information on people, especially when you're working at a bank, and that way they can sell their mortgages to you depending on where you live, what type of job you do. All that information absolutely goes into it. So are people going to start saying, oh, we better burn it and get rid of it? Or what can we start to see happening? Because people are starting to get a little bit more clued on with having their data out there. Do you really need to take my date of birth, Mr. Cafe? There's all these things that people are starting to ask more questions, as opposed to what I've sort of seen in the last decade. People didn't even ask questions. They just give it away. Now people are starting to push back and ask those questions. But do you think companies will take it seriously and then therefore start doing data backburning?
I would hope so. And I think a lot of that's going to come down to the fact that, you go back to the one key piece. What are your crown jewels in the organization? And if you don't know what your crown jewels are, you definitely want to find out. What is something that potentially could expose us in the future? And if we've been collecting data, we should have a bit of an understanding of what that data is. If we don't need it, or it's past its use-by date, think about some of the breaches that we've seen. If you were no longer a current customer, they still had your data. They still had your ID. Why is that? So I think there should be an element of we start to, deprecate some of the data that has been collected, and in particular, the IDs. We should be looking at a way to, how do we even centralize the ID process? Rather than everyone collecting every single copy of your driver's license, why don't we have a central location where they can simply do some sort of authentication, verification, and authorization on that data, on your ID, to see, are you who you are? And if you are, great, tick in the box. I don't need a copy of your data. Of your driver's license, that is, because I've actually been verified somehow. We have to be having these conversations now to work out there must be a better way, because every single thing that we ever do in our lives usually requires some form of ID to be presented. Someone takes a copy of it. Are they going to be keeping it? How are they going to be protecting it? Where is it located? They're questions that should be asked inside an organization.
Yeah, and you're so right. And these are the questions I had last year with the breach that happened last year. It was like, well, why do they need to keep it? Why do they need to keep Sean Duke's license? When you just want to authenticate and then get rid of it, why would you want to hold that risk? Why are people still thinking, I need to hold on to it?
Correct. And I think that's the question that we should be asking. And hopefully we're going to see some laws come out that will change the way that we think about this. And I think we need to ensure that we've got some form of national lens. And if I look at some of the words that have been used by Andy Penn and that the cyber team that have basically been put together to work out what our cyber strategy is, a lot of that is really based on an all-of-nation approach to deal with cyber, which is a great thing. I think we need to start to collectively think about, okay, if that particular sector does this, that sector does nothing, how do we actually get some sort of harmony around that? So there'll probably be a case where we'll see some new regulations or rules that come out, but hopefully that also means that we'll end up deprecating some of the older ones that we've got. And I think hopefully we end up seeing a world where people just understand these are the rules of the road. You shouldn't be keeping data past X amount of years. What type of data can you keep? And if you want to try and measure some way of, accessing a way that you can get someone's identification, it should simply be a checkbox. Because I'm concerned that you've got a lot of small businesses that aren't really thinking about how they should be protecting their data. And in the end, it's our data. And how many more times can we actually change our driver's license? If you think about biometric data being stolen, how do we do that? How do you change your iris? How do you change your fingerprints? We can't do that. But let's not get into that world. Let's start fixing the problem before it becomes a problem.
So true. I do need to change my driver's license photo. It's been 10 years and you can't keep having a driver's license on 10 years, I've been told. So Sean, thanks so much for your time. In terms of any closing comments or any final thoughts? Is there anything you'd like to leave our audience with today?
I think the big question that I would leave for all the audience members is start having the conversation today. You know, no one ever picks their team the day of the game. So find out who your team is, number one. Secondly, start to have the questions and conversations around what is considered our crown jewels. You know, so I take the example of, you know, Palo Alto Networks as a technology company. You know, our source code repository is key. You know, SAP for how we can actually track our billings. You know, my mobile phone is not considered material if I was to lose that or it got destroyed or it got attacked somehow. But find out where your crown jewels are and start asking the question, where is it located? Who's got access to it? You know, how is it protected? You know, start to ask these questions and build some sort of muscle memory around this, because when something does happen, you want to ensure that you've got a plan and you need to be prepared, and that preparedness actually starts today.
Well, thanks for that. Thanks for your insightful knowledge, because again, like I want to give answers to people. I want to give them tangible insights to things that they can do today. So Sean, as always, thank you for your time and thanks for coming on the show.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by Mercsec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit mercsec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.